for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Bruce Ivins was an emotionally troubled scientist. For 20 years, he had unlimited access to the U.S. Army's store of anthrax. When letters laced with the deadly toxin killed 5 people, law enforcement agents focused their suspicions on another man. In a new book, an investigative reporter takes us back to the anthrax scare that shortly followed 9/11 and explains why the way the government handled the investigation is relevant even today. His new book is titled The Mirage Man, and author David Wiltman joins me in the studio. You can join us as well, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, David. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Diane. It's an honor.
Take us back to those days shortly after 9/11 and what led up to the anthrax attacks.
Okay, correct. The 9/11 events, the most horrific terrorism this country's ever suffered, had this country reeling, certainly had Washington reeling as it's never reeled before. And right on the heels of that, we had the anthrax letter attacks. The first death was on October 5th of 2001.
And who would that have been?
That was a fellow named Robert Stevens, who was a photo editor down at the parent offices of the National Enquirer in Lantana, Florida. The big event that I think really put the anthrax letter attacks on the map as what looked like the second wave of perhaps an Islamic terrorist event was the October 15th, 2001 opening of a letter addressed to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle in the Senate Hard Office Building.
And once that happened, what happened next?
Well, once that happened, I mean, our government had been struck at its core. And there was nothing short of panic. All of us who lived in Washington at that time, I think it's safe to say many of us were scared to death. So the FBI immediately took over what had been an investigation that was controlled by health authorities because it wasn't quite definite to all the authorities as to whether the first event down there in Florida was terrorism or maybe a natural event. So that letter that was addressed to Senator Daschle was immediately taken by the authorities, not to the FBI laboratory because they're not equipped to handle a live agent. It was taken to Fort Detrick, Maryland, which is home of the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, which is the biowarfare research center of the U.S. military.
I can remember even here at this station feeling a certain amount of fear opening an ordinary envelope, and that fear, that terror spread throughout the country, not just Washington.
It certainly did. I mean, a benign portal of our daily lives, the mailbox, had become an instrument of death.
And as a matter of fact, 2 workers at a postal facility here in Washington, D.C., died as a result.
Right. 5 people ultimately died of inhalational anthrax, including 2 fellows who worked at the Brentwood Postal Facility in Northeast Washington. There were, of course, the editor, Robert Stevens, down in Florida, and we had a woman in New York who was a hospital worker in Manhattan and a woman in Oxford, Connecticut, a rural town there named Audley Lundgren.
David Wiltman, as a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist for the Los Angeles Times, tell me why you decided to go back and look even more deeply and carefully at these incidents.
Well, I had been looking at our spending to prevent and to react proactively to events of biological terrorism for several years. And it was my experience leading through 2008 in actually doing the very first articles about the big break in the case that followed the tragic suicide of Bruce Ivins on July 29, 2008, that the most fundamental facts surrounding the anthrax letter attacks were greatly confused at best, and even perhaps vandalized at worst. And that seemed very important to me, and still does. It drove me to do this book because there are enormous lessons to be learned to apply going forward. We had tremendous national security policy implications that were a direct result of the anthrax letter attacks.
Tell me about Bruce Ivins.
Bruce Ivins was born in a small town called Lebanon, Ohio. He was a gifted scientific student from the beginning, but he, although the town of Lebanon, and I spent a lot of time in my research talking to Bruce Ivins' schoolmates, adults who knew him as a child, and also family members, but reconstructing his early life and then on through all the way into his 60s. He was gifted scientifically, had a really, I think you have to say, a just a horrific home life experience where his father, who was the pharmacist at the longtime family-owned drugstore established in 1893 in Lebanon, was routinely beaten by Bruce's mother, and it was just a frightening atmosphere. Bruce was the youngest of three children, and was his activities were micromanaged, I think you would say, by her. A lot of us know people who come from tough experiences and overcome it. Bruce had a tough time doing that.
Now, was he also beaten by his mother?
Not to my knowledge, he was not.
None of the children, only the father.
Well, I think the father bore the brunt of it, and rather dramatically. I mean, if again, the research in the book, one of the most, I think, saddening things that I found was in sitting down with neighbors and hearing the story how early in the morning, in the darkened hours, 2 a.m., a doctor who lives some 300 yards down the street on Orchard Avenue in Lebanon, Ohio, got a phone call from Mary Ivins, who was Bruce's mother, Randall's wife, saying, saying, please come down here. I've killed Randall.
Ah.
And he came to the door, did the doctor, and found to his great surprise that Randall Ivins answered the door, but his head caked in blood. He was holding a garment up next to his head. The doctor treated him on the spot and, in fact, sent him a bill for it.
But that incident was never reported to the police?
To my knowledge, it was not reported to the police. No, it was not. It was a poorly kept secret in Lebanon, Ohio, these incidents.
Now tell us about Stephen Hatfill.
Stephen Hatfill was a virologist who had a sort of a wide-ranging career, but he worked up at Fort Detrick from 1997 to September of 1999 studying viruses. And in the aftermath of the anthrax letter attacks, several of his present or former colleagues, he had obviously moved out of Fort Detrick by 1999, called the authorities, said, you really ought to look hard at this fellow. And boy, did the FBI look hard at him. Stephen Hatfill then became the subject of a torrent of leaks of highly prejudicial, often misleading or false investigative details.
Why do you
details.
Think that was?
Well, hard to know, Diane. I think the conclusion where I would come out on that is why the leaks of investigative details, obviously from within the investigation, is that the FBI, we remember, was under enormous pressure in the aftermath of September the 11th, let alone when the anthrax letter attacks hit. Ample evidence that the FBI failed to interdict and to act on, I think you'd have to say, actionable information that perhaps would have disrupted the 9/11 attacks. And so you have the anthrax attacks, and just a frenzy in Washington. Even the FBI's mission is being called into question on Capitol Hill, whether they're going to be stripped of a big part of their portfolio. And so I think there was a strong interest among certain people who were involved and had access to the investigative details to try and assure the public that we're on top of this. And we've got a guy who we think is a very solid prime suspect. And look at these details we're giving you. We're on top of the situation. You can trust your FBI.
David Willman, he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who writes for the Los Angeles Times. His new book is titled The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks, and America's Rush to War. Tell me how being under such scrutiny and feeling the pressure from the FBI affected Stephen Hatfill's life.
Well, the FBI, when it came to Stephen Hatfill, had him under overt, you can call it bumper lock surveillance, 24/7. Whenever he stepped out in public, he was being videotaped and followed overtly. So he lost the job that he had, and it was very difficult, if not impossible, obviously, for him to get new jobs. Then he did land a job at Louisiana State University for $150,000 a year, teaching first responders in the area of preparedness in the event of a biological attack. Seemed to be right within his area of expertise, but the Justice Department intervened. This was a Justice Department grant-funded job. The Justice Department intervened and directly resulted in him being terminated from that job. So very tough times for Stephen Hatfill. He is, as we all know, sued the FBI and the Justice Department, alleging violations of his rights to privacy. And to get ahead of the story a little bit, ultimately in June of 2008, won a settlement from the government, a legal settlement worth $5.82 million.
Wow. Incredible. What about the media? What kind of job did the media do?
Well, this was far from the media's finest hour. And you know, Diane, you asked me at the beginning why I set out to do the book. In setting out to do the book, I decided that I was just going to let the chips fall where they may. And writing about colleagues who have had unfortunate turns on this story is not a pleasant thing, but it's obvious that we can't set the record straight about the anthrax letter attacks and then learn lessons from them that apply directly to our public safety without letting the chips fall where they may. And so there were it's almost innumerable leaks and misleading, if not inaccurate, reports about Stephen Hatfill. I mean, I spend time in the book talking about a particular New York Times columnist, Nick Kristof, who's had a distinguished career, but his body of work on Stephen Hatfill and the anthrax case is anything but.
We're talking about a new book, The Mirage Man, with author David Willman. Welcome back. We are talking about the anthrax attacks that came on the heels of 9/11. A new book titled The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks and America's Rush to War, is the book written by David Willman. He's a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Do join us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. The phones are open now. You can join us also on Facebook or Twitter. David Willman, you think that the FBI badly botched the investigation.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that, Diane. I mean, for the better part of 5 years, the FBI had Stephen Hatfill as the prime suspect in this case, was pushing the case all the way from the director's office through to the lead prosecutor on the case to try and bring it to indictment. And actually, it was one of the prosecutors who ultimately resisted that very strongly. But for the better part of 5 years, I think it needs to be said that the FBI was entirely, within the grounds of reason to look very hard at Stephen Hatfield initially, but the evidence just never matched up. I mean, he was a virologist. Again, anthrax is a bacterium. He had no documented access to this particular unique batch of anthrax that was used in the attacks, or even the Ames strain for that matter, and no documented evidence that he ever handled anthrax, let alone knew how to purify it, to dry it and to handle it in this highly expert way.
What about his colleagues? Did they sort of speak out surreptitiously against him?
Well, as I tried to make clear, there were several of his present or former colleagues who called the authorities and said, you really need to look hard at this guy. And, you know, Stephen Hatfield is a very swashbuckling figure, had fabricated parts of his resume, which does not inspire confidence.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I think merited serious scrutiny was that he had several prescriptions for Cipro, original prescriptions and or refills in 2001. Turns out when that gets checked out, he had a deviated septum. In fact, on September the 11th of 2001, he was undergoing surgery
The Cipro suspect?
Well, because as we learned in the aftermath of the anthrax letter attacks, Cipro became sort of the recommended drug of choice as an antibiotic to treat an anthrax infection. However, it should also be said that thanks to some very good work at Fort Detrick in the aftermath of the letter from Senator Daschle and other anthrax attack material taken there, no fewer than 10, 12, a dozen or more antibiotics proved to be very effective against all of this anthrax used in the letter attacks, including penicillin, including doxycycline, which are far cheaper and not with some of the potential powerful side effects as Cipro has.
Now, Doug in D.C. has just sent us an email saying, luckily, the anthrax was rather easily killed with bleach, something cheap and common.
Well, if you know that anthrax is on a particular surface, you have reasons to suspect that it's there, it can be killed and cleaned away with bleach. In fact, Bruce Ivins did a very good job of that in his own office area in the weeks or month following the letter attacks. But the key thing with inhalational anthrax is if you suspect that you have anthrax, get treatment with an antibiotic right away.
I see. Who is Nancy Hagwood? And why did she alert authorities?
Nancy Hagwood is a microbiologist who first met Bruce Ivins when Bruce Ivins was a postdoctoral researcher at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill in the mid-1970s. Nancy at that time was a doctoral student and was going about doing her business. Bruce Ivins immediately really focused in on her and wanted her not only attention but her constant approval, and seemed very animated by the fact that Nancy Hagwood one day had worn a T-shirt that had the name Kappa Kappa Gamma on it, which was Nancy's college sorority. In fact, on campus there, she was well known as a mentor to undergrads who were Kappas. She becomes a through line in the Bruce Ivins story because he never really let loose of his obsession with her. He tormented her in various ways over a period of decades. After he had left Chapel Hill as a postdoctoral researcher and moved up to Maryland, he made a surreptitious trip down there, broke into a laboratory office area, stole her lab notebook, upon which her doctoral degree hinged, and then sent her an anonymous note saying, if you want your lab notebook back, go look in this mailbox here in Chapel Hill at this corner, and you'll find it there. Of course, this is before flash drives. This is before backups. Nancy Hagwood's entire scientific future, as she could see it then, hinged on this notebook. All of her experiment, all of her data was in there. So with the help of the authorities, the notebook was recovered, and she went on to get her doctorate. Bruce Ivins then would do things to her, write one notorious anonymous letter that I'm thinking of in May of 1983 to the Frederick News Post here in Maryland, claiming to be Nancy Hagwood, defending hazing practices by sororities, and then I think more diabolically took that letter as published by the Frederick News Post and sent it to a woman whose son had died in a hazing incident with the hopes of then getting that woman who had become active in trying to prevent hazing abuses to send him first-person anecdotes, dirt, if you will, about Kappa Kappa Gamma. To tie off the story very quickly, Diane, Nancy Hagwood is crucial here because on September 21st, 2001, which is 3 days after only the perpetrator knows that the first round of anthrax letters had been postmarked up in New Jersey, Bruce Ivins contacts Nancy Hagwood out of the blue and predicts a big event, a big terrorist event that's going to put Fort Detrick front and center with 24/7 on-call emergency response. And again, if you look at Bruce Ivins' life, he lives for the attention, for the approval, and this was almost a predictive event.
Now, wasn't there an earlier obsession on his part with the sorority?
Yeah, the genesis of his obsession, as best as I can tell in my research for this book, came while he was an undergraduate at the University of Cincinnati in probably the late 1960s. He asked a woman out for a date, and she said no. She quickly forgot about it. He never did. And he attributed the rejection of him to her membership in Kappa Kappa Gamma. So he began casing the Kappa House in Cincinnati, and this became an obsession for him all the way into his 60s. He died at age 62.
He ultimately committed suicide.
He did. He died of a massive overdose of Tylenol PM, and the packaging for the Tylenol PM was found in his trash a couple days after his death. One more thing on Nancy Hagwood. I'm sorry, Diane, just to get a little bit ahead of the story.
Absolutely.
But in late January, I believe it was January 29th of 2002, which is, as you know, several months after the anthrax letter attacks, the FBI, with the cooperation of the American Society for Microbiology, sent a letter under the name of an FBI agent to, I think, all 30,000 United States-based members of the Microbiology Association saying, we need your help. One of you, perhaps more of you, knows who the perpetrator is. Please think about it. Here's a little profile of who we think this is. Nancy Hagwood gets this letter in Seattle, Washington, and puts it together with all of her life experience with Bruce Ivins, including the predictive September 21st, 2001 email, and an email that he also sent her that had pictures of him handling the plates of anthrax as he was helping the, quote, investigation in the immediate aftermath of the Daschle letter going up there. Her reflexive reaction was, oh, my God, I think I know who did it. She called the FBI. Her tip essentially went unpursued for several years while the FBI had Stephen Hatfill up in lights.
In effect, he was saying to her, I am doing this. He was wanting the attention that would come with having done this, and yet he was doing it in such a way that he wouldn't be caught.
Well, Nancy Hagwood, and I've spent a lot of time with her, obviously, is anything but a melodramatic person. And she interpreted it pretty much as you say, Diane. She thought it was an example of Bruce showing, look how smart I am, and cowboying it even. He was so far ahead of the authorities. I mean, here he is. He's handling the Daschle letter up there at Fort Detrick, which is another story that I break in this book. Of how he came to handle the Daschle letter. The FBI had a protocol for handling that evidence, but it was not handled by that protocol. A senior scientist at Fort Detrick saw to it that not just a sample of anthrax from the Daschle letter, but the entire envelope that was addressed to Senator Daschle, including the anthrax, was handed over to Bruce Ivins for analysis. Again, totally contrary to the protocol. And this breaks the chain of custody on the evidence. This is really a horrible thing, as anybody who's in criminal investigation can attest. So there he was at the epicenter, as he had predicted in the September 21st email.
Why do you suppose that the FBI went instead and persisted instead with Stephen Hatfill?
Well, they had what they thought was a very live suspect. This was the first anthrax murder that the FBI had ever investigated. So it's a very steep scientific hill to climb. And they were trying as hard as they could. I think at the time of the anthrax letter attacks, the FBI had, I think, two microbiologists working the case, or within the Bureau totally. Now, they quickly started ramping that up, but it was tough for them to get on top of it. They had a live suspect. The director was under enormous pressure, and as one of the things I bring out in this book is that the director really was managing this case. He put his handpicked inspector in charge of this case as of September, October of 2002, and he remained in that place for better part of 4 years. And there was every expectation that with that new leadership that the director had put in and was reporting directly to the director, I should say, that this case would be buttoned up for the indictment of Stephen Hatfill very quickly.
And you have a certain amount of disrespect for Robert Mueller.
Actually, I have supreme respect for Robert Mueller. I think he is a noble public servant. He, throughout his entire career, he is clean as a hound's tooth, without a speck of corruption. He is a man who actually grew up in some privilege in Philadelphia, but yet he served in Vietnam, a war he could have avoided, and he served with distinction. He's devoted almost all of his career to public service. I just think that he obviously got this case dead wrong for way too long, and there were huge opportunity costs, and really the Bureau nor the country has really come to reckon with this so we can learn the essential lessons.
And what do you believe they are? What do you believe are the essential lessons?
Well, clearly we have a huge problem in this country with securing our anthrax and securing our crown jewel of biodefense, which is at Fort Detrick. But yet the country's response to the anthrax letter attacks, first of all, the anthrax letter attacks helped push the Patriot Act immediately over the goal line for passage. And I went back and talked to members of the Senate, member of the House. There was no chance for further debate of the Patriot Act after the anthrax letter attacks. Secondly, the anthrax letter attacks were immediately seized upon by people who really wanted to take out Saddam Hussein. Wildly inaccurate media reports helped amplify that hysteria, and that lingers to this day. But the other part of this is that direct response to the anthrax letter attacks was this really mass proliferation of biocontainment laboratories for, again, a good, well-intentioned purpose, which is to develop new vaccines, antibiotics that can help protect us in the event of a biological attack, God forbid. However, we've gone through this massive expansion, and I've recreated the record. I've attended a pivotal advisory committee meeting on this, at which there was just mass denial that Bruce Ivins could have been the one. So there's no lesson to be learned about hardening up our personnel reliability and our security at these labs. So we're proliferating the labs. We've brought in thousands of new scientists here in the United States to handle any of these long list of select agents, be it anthrax, plague, tularemia, et cetera, without, I think, a very serious consideration of new security restrictions that we need to have. The other thing that happened in direct response to the anthrax letter attacks, Diane, was that Project BioShield was passed, which provides billions of dollars for developing these new therapeutics. And the first contract that was awarded under Project BioShield was for $877.5 million for a next-generation genetically engineered anthrax vaccine, upon which Bruce Ivins held two patents. That product was dead in the water before the anthrax letter attacks. Mm-hmm. Bruce Ivins was furious, frustrated about that, and I think is a big part of what would have motivated him.
David Wildman, and the book we're talking about is called The Mirage Man. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you. In case there are any of your listeners who are having a difficult time with your subject this morning, I worked with an anti-terrorist team during the 80s and the early 90s based in the West. We often trained with FBI, Drug Enforcement agents, and other branches of law enforcement. Excuse me. And Hollywood often portrays these people in superhuman terms. They are, in fact, human beings and capable of human flaws. And I just wanted to make clear that the people that I trained with, for the most part, was kind of disheartening because they acted like big guys playing cowboys and Indians, but with real guns and real authority. So are they capable of this kind of incompetence? Yes, they are. And I just wanted to assure the people that they are listening to some real information here. And thank you.
Well, thank you, David. I think the caller makes a very valid point, and it really ties into, Diane, your questions about how the FBI could get on this long track with Stephen Hatfield. What became the linchpin of evidence against Stephen Hatfield, and I put evidence in quotes, were the reactions of three bloodhounds that the FBI brought in from Southern California, who were said to be able to trace the scent of Stephen Hatfield and the material from the letters to Stephen Hatfield's apartment, to five separate ponds in forest land above Frederick. and supposedly where Stephen Hatfield was loading anthrax into a plastic device underwater or perhaps right on the shore and dragging it in. This is really, I think, hocus pocus. The sad thing is, and I think the only fair evaluation of the FBI or any investigative authority is what did they know in real time? And as I bring out in this book, I mean, I reconstructed two high-profile cases in California that were covered extensively by the Los Angeles Times. One of these cases ultimately was featured by 60 Minutes, too. These bloodhounds were, their credibility was absolutely repudiated and shredded in a murder case and a rape case. In the rape case, this one dog named Tinkerbell had traced the supposed perpetrator for 2 miles, better than 2 miles, in a zigzag fashion, ultimately to this poor gentleman's apartment complex. He was jailed for 4 months, awaiting trial on serial rape charges. There had been some 9 rapes in the Belmont Shore area of Long Beach. Fortunately, some much more solid evidence was recovered by the authorities there, human DNA from one of the victims that ultimately tied to the actual perpetrator, who is now serving a prison term, I believe, of over 1,000 years. But the poor gentleman who is falsely accused, he won a settlement from the authorities of over $1 million. This was all very well documented ahead of time. And that bloodhound, Tinkerbell, was the first bloodhound that, quote, alerted on Stephen Hatfield at his apartment in Frederick, Maryland.
All of which says to me that if an assumption is there to begin with, you can go a long way toward supporting your assumption. The book is titled The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks, and America's Rush to War. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Jim Shepherd tells us why his newest book is a collection of short stories.
I think I'm attracted in the short story form to the notion that I will make less money and reach fewer people.
Shepherd's book, You Think That's Bad, is filled with tales that blend fact and fiction, like the one about the real-life creator of Godzilla. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
We're back talking with David Willman about his new book, The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks, and America's Rush to War. Here's an email from Shana, who says, I worked at U.S. Amerid 1996 to 2000, and Bruce Ivins was always a strange, quiet guy. He seemed harmless, volunteered frequently with blood drives, etc. Steve Hatfield was a braggart and a bit of a blowhard. He also embellished his abilities, experience, and military record. These actions drew a lot of FBI suspicion, and falsifying his military service on his resume is what eliminated Steve from his position here at Louisiana State University.
Well, I have no verification of that at all, and if that is the case, I'd like to see that. I've put that question to the Justice Department and have never received such a response.
Here's an email, and apparently several have sent this in. The more your guest speaks and reveals, the more and more it sounds as if there is possible evidence of a conspiracy. Could this attack have been part of an attempt to create panic in defense of the Patriot Act, which slipped beyond the control of its original mechanism? That's from Daniel in St. Louis, Missouri.
That type of question continues to arise, and it's obviously hard to, or if not impossible, to disprove any number of theories. I look toward the evidence that I have reviewed in over 2.5, 3 years of research on this book, and I think the totality of the evidence points toward the culpability of one individual, and that is a highly skilled microbiologist whose career expertise was in handling, growing, purifying anthrax, also with a demonstrated expertise in drying these types of materials. And he had, a lifelong track record of perpetrating anonymous acts of torment and revenge as a solo actor. In other words, he didn't confide in other people. He was doing all these things. That is his pattern.
But you do argue that the Bush administration used the anthrax scare to gain support for invading Iraq.
There's no question about that. The anthrax letter attacks were really a gift that fell in the lap of those in the Bush administration who wanted to take out Saddam Hussein, many of them in very prominent positions since the first Gulf War. And in fact, Don Rumsfeld, John Bolton, and Paul Wolfowitz were among three people who signed a letter to then-President Clinton in 1998 saying that the only acceptable solution was to take out Saddam. So they were gunning for him from the beginning, and there was a big effort to try and pin 9/11 on Saddam. But then here you have the anthrax letter attacks written with an Islamic type of message, I think very clumsily so. Obviously, I think a careful reading of it shows that it's bogus. But people were only too happy to latch on to that. Secretary Rumsfeld continued to sort of throw palms up in the face of incontrovertible evidence that this material was not linkable to Iraq. The Sandia National Laboratories proved it. Other people within the defense and intelligence establishment proved it conclusively. But yet he throws palms up, says we just don't know. Paul Wolfowitz, whom I interviewed for this book, said as recently as October of last year, well, we just can't know. So these are very dramatic things, none more dramatic than Colin Powell at the United Nations on February 5th, 2003, immediately preceding the start of the Iraq War, holding up a tiny little vial of white powder and saying, just this much powder killed two of our postal workers here in Washington and set off all these, closed down the buildings.
So somehow linking that.
Oh, definitely by implication. I mean, he left that implication. He did not say it directly that it was attributable, but he left the impression, did nothing to correct it.
All right. To Wichita, Kansas. Good morning, Kendall.
Good morning. Slightly after his suicide, the FBI contacted my sister, and she discovered that she had been somewhat of a target of his, that he had been stalking her and collecting materials about her. She had been a contestant on a reality show, one of the first ones that was hosted by Anderson Cooper, called The Mole. And she learned that he had been trying to find correct emails from her and had been collecting information about her and so forth. I was wondering if you could speak to anything you know about that and if there were other subjects of his that were discovered after his death.
Yes. Well, Kendall, indeed, Bruce Ivins targeted Catherine Price, who was a star.
Yeah, that's my sister, right.
Wow, this is amazing. She obviously was a star of The Mole, and Bruce Ivins was posting anonymously on internet boards and trying to find out what her travel schedule was. He was posing as a quote-unquote fan of hers and had thoroughly reconstructed what her career was. As you know, she graduated from Stanford Law School, was a very impressive young woman. And Bruce Ivins, in fact, actually wrote on one of the boards that he was criticizing how one of the segments of the reality show turned out. He said that someone on the show should have used an ice pick and taken out her eyes and then
and
chopped her jugular and really finished the job. Absolutely shocking, and I think showed the hidden side rage that Bruce Ivins had. I mean, to many of his colleagues who I think in good faith saw him as he presented himself, he was sort of a jester. He was the quirky guy, but not unlike a magician who is showing you quirky with one hand, it's the other hand where he's doing some really very nasty and I think societally unhinged things.
Kendall, I hope your sister is well.
She's doing great.
Good.
She's doing great.
I'm
Thank
glad.
You.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
To Scott in Oklahoma City. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
As I told your screener, I'm a retired FBI agent, and I wanted to make just a general comment about investigations in particular. I didn't work on anything as exciting as the anthrax case. But your term is assumption, I think, is in the right ballpark. Sometimes you get focused on something to such an extent that you don't give other possibilities the attention they deserve. Earlier today on NPR, there was a story about what happened with a Boston police officer chasing a subject, and he got sent to prison because no one believed he couldn't see just as he ran by other officers beating up an undercover agent. So I think it's a very human failing, which we need to try to overcome. And sometimes I think when someone's ruled out, you don't necessarily review things and go back over it as you should. Law enforcement officers need to be confident, but sometimes overconfidence leads to those kind of mistakes where you, once someone's ruled out, you just keep focusing on the prize, as it were, without truly stepping back and taking a look at everything.
I appreciate your call, Scott.
Well, I think Scott makes really an essential point, and this goes to really, I think, more of a heroic side of the FBI investigation that also needs to be recognized by people and, in my view, has not been adequately noticed, including by the FBI director. There were two new people put in charge of this case as of October of 2006, and to the FBI director's credit, he actually installed them. His handpicked inspector who had been leading the case had transferred down to Knoxville, Tennessee. But these two individuals, Edward Montooth and Vincent Lissy, told everyone on the Amerithrax task force that, time out, we're going to reassess all assumptions about leads and suspects that have occurred in this case, and we're going to follow the evidence where it takes us. And that reassessment pretty quickly led to the decoupling of Stephen Hatfill as a serious suspect in this case, and focused on those people who had verifiable, documented access to this highly rare batch of anthrax that Bruce Ivins, in fact, had created in 1997 at Fort Detrick. And so the investigation just narrowed down from this field of people. And that whole, in reconstructing that effort for my book, you know, Scott's conclusion really rings so true, because the opportunity cost of all of the hullabaloo over Stephen Hatfill was, even among investigators, an assumption that, well, why should I go the extra mile here and there? Because we've got our guy. They wouldn't be leaking all this stuff to the media and burying Stephen Hatfill if there wasn't a lot to it.
Interesting. All right. To Purdue University. Good morning, David.
Hello. Want to thank you for the discussion today. I'm a biodefense researcher, and I've seen a lot from the inside, and I think the most important point, which you've partially touched on, but I think it needs to be really made strong, is that Bruce Ivins achieved everything he wanted to achieve, and that is, he wanted people to be focused on biodefense as a real threat. He wanted people to focus specifically on anthrax. Now, anthrax is barely, I know this sounds counterintuitive, but it's barely a biological weapon because you have to be exposed to it directly. It cannot be passed person to person as opposed to something like smallpox or Ebola, which is what I work on. And so a lot of the money has gone specifically focused on anthrax because of Bruce Ivins. And so I think this is one of the most important messages is that we let terrorists get what they want. They want to make us afraid. They want us to focus on their particular issues. And I think that's one of the largest messages.
However, David, it seems to me that Bruce Ivins could have done that without killing people. David.
Well, Bruce Ivins was definitely a student of what it takes to move bureaucracy in this country. And I think one of the, I hope, contributions that this book makes is I reconstruct Bruce Ivins' animation and his excitement during the Persian Gulf War. He was called in to be one of very few people at Fort Detrick to help see what preparations needed to be made in the way of countermeasures in the event of a biological attack on our troops by Saddam in the first Persian Gulf War. So he saw how all the supposed impediments can be swept away with crisis. And these letters are addressed to a very discreet list of institutions and people that guaranteed maximum shock and awe. He achieved it, as I said earlier, the first contract under Project BioShield, which I'm sure the caller may have on his mind, David, was for $877.5 million for the development of the baby, Bruce Ivins' baby, as I call it in the book, which was the next generation, the genetically engineered anthrax vaccine. Bruce Ivins knew from his personal meetings down at the Pentagon, he was being sent down there by Fort Detrick personnel officials to talk to the Pentagon folks about the status of the anthrax vaccine program, that his product was absolutely dead in the water. In the words of the supervising major general, who is quoted for the first time in this book, the anthrax next generation vaccine was, quote, beyond the back burner, wasn't going to happen without crisis. Here we are.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. You call him the Mirage Man. Why?
Well, because I think Bruce Ivins presents a mirage. He seems to be one thing to most of the people he runs into, but he's not that glass of water. I mean, he's something else. So, not unlike if you've ever driven across the desert and you look on the horizon and you think maybe something life-saving and good is up there. No, it's not. Yeah. So I think that's the key to his, really, you have to say, his effectiveness in what he was doing here. I mean, no one knew that he was harassing and tormenting these women over this period of years. No one knew that he was saying these horrendous things about Catherine Price. No one knew that he had confided to a psychiatrist in 1979 that, in fact, he had a plot to kill Nancy Hagwood. And the United States Army, one of the real outrages here, and the shock, one of the most shocking things in my research for the book, Diane, is that the United States Army never took a single step to evaluate Dr. Ivins' mental fitness for handling anthrax. This was revealed to me in response to a Freedom of Information Act request that I had originally made while I was on staff for the Los Angeles
Why
Times.
Why would they not do that?
The atmosphere up there, unlike, we should make clear, if you're handling chemical warfare material or nuclear material, live fissile material for the United States government, and if there's any hint of instability, you're immediately taken out of sensitive work, and there's a concerted effort to get on top of the issue.
Hey, now.
Right, there's no now. Delay. You're pulled out immediately.
Okay.
With Bruce Ivins, not the case. What happened was there was this deference to him as a respected scientist, a PhD scientist, and an over-tilting toward his rights of privacy. And this was just cockeyed.
Did the FBI ever apologize to Stephen Hatfield?
Yes. Of course, the FBI and the Justice Department were parties to the $5.82 million legal settlement in June, but there was no apology there. In the aftermath of the first FBI Justice press conference announcing that Bruce Ivins, what they were saying, was the sole perpetrator, the lawyer for Stephen Hatfield wrote rather pointedly to the Justice Department, say, hey, wait a minute, you asked at this press conference about Stephen Hatfield, you won't even say his name, which was true. And what happened was that then a letter was sent to Stephen Hatfield's lawyer explicitly apologizing. It was signed by the then United States Attorney in Washington, D.C., Jeffrey Taylor.
But Robert Mueller?
Well, Robert Mueller, this really surprised me. I mean, the FBI held a big press conference on August 6, 2008, several days after Bruce Ivins had died of suicide. And this was the moment to preside over what the American people were being told was the conclusion of the most significant, most complicated case that certainly came out of our 9/11 trauma, and I believe one of the most consequential series of crimes in American history. And the FBI director did not attend. He was in Washington. He was right across the street. He chose not to attend.
Why?
Well, only he can answer that. But based on some other responses that I've seen him given impromptu, I don't think Director Mueller wants to answer public questions about his direct role in pushing the investigation toward the indictment of Stephen Hatfield.
And you believe he had a direct role in that?
In the words of former senior FBI official Michael Mason, who became the agent in charge of the Washington field office, and I quote him saying this for the first time in this book, there was only one person in charge of the anthrax investigation, and that was Director Mueller.
David Willman. His new book is titled The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks, and America's Rush to War. Congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Katie June Friesen answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.